Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us. Following the President's State of the Union address, senior administration officials, the Vice President, even the President have been answering your questions in a series of live online events. Today we've had roundtables on the economy, foreign policy, and right now we're so pleased to have with us Secretary of Education Arne Duncan for a live roundtable discussion on education. I'm Corey Shulman in the Department of New Media, and to my right is Secretary of Education Arne Duncan. I'll just go around the table. We have Rob Lippincott from PBS Teachers, Liz Dwyer from Good, Kevin Short of MTVU, and Linda Murray from Baby Center. For the past couple of days, Rob, Liz, Kevin, and Linda have been taking questions for Secretary Duncan from their readers. We'll also be taking your questions live. If you go to whitehouse.gov/live, there's a link to join a chat on Facebook. I'll be scanning that throughout the duration, and we'll be taking your questions for the Secretary as well. So without further ado, we'll just jump into our first question. I'm going to turn it over to Kevin from MTVU to ask the Secretary your first question.
Absolutely. Thank you. While reforms are taking place on a federal level, state budgets paint a very different picture. In my home state of California, for example, Governor Jerry Brown has proposed $500 million of cuts to state higher education funding. And I understand that budgets are constricted, but is it appropriate for states to put education on the chopping block? How do you plan on counteracting these gargantuan cuts, and what can college students do to voice their opinions?
These are very tough times, and states around the country are making very tough budget cuts. California is probably as hard hit as anybody, and so there aren't easy answers. I'll say a couple things. I'll say in tough times, when I ran the Chicago Public Schools, unfortunately I had to cut budgets year after year after year and make tough decisions. There are smart, strategic ways to do it in ways that hurt children and hurt college students, and so we're really pushing folks where they have to make tough calls to be very, very thoughtful about how they do it. We were very successful in the past through the Recovery Act to be able to save a couple hundred thousand teacher jobs, and hopefully some of that will continue. But the honest reality is we at the federal level can't stave off all the tough decisions that the states and locals have to make. So we're trying to be very, very clear that we have to think thoughtfully about what we're calling the new normal. How do we become more productive, more efficient in tough times? How do we think about using technology to help reduce costs and become more efficient and still get great results for young people and college students? What we've tried to do, particularly in the college side, is to make college much more accessible and affordable. So simplifying the FAFSA form, we stopped subsidizing banks, took all those savings, put those into Pell Grants, $40 billion over the next decade in increased Pell Grants. Significant savings once you graduate, if you go into the public sector, if you teach, after 10 years of public service, all your debt is forgiven, so that was a big step in the right direction. And then last week we announced with the Department of Labor $2 billion for community colleges, for two-year institutions, so we're trying to make a huge investment there. So we're trying to do everything we can to be a good partner, but it doesn't by any means say that there aren't very, very tough decisions being made at state and local level across the country.
Thanks. I'm going to turn it over to Linda from Baby Center.
I represent moms. Baby Center is the largest online site for new and expectant moms, and so our questions are a lot about elementary school and young children. No Child Left Behind is the number one question that we've received from our audience, and our moms really want to know, how is the new plan different from No Child Left Behind, and how do you create an environment where we aren't teaching to the test and we can really get out of this cycle we're in?
Yeah, and that mom audience is so important to us. I speak to the Mom Congress every year. It's one of my favorite points of the year. So we fundamentally think that No Child Left Behind has to be fixed. There's a lot that's broken there. Let me sort of walk through a couple things I think are wrong and where we want to go. The current law is far too punitive. There are about 50 different ways to fail and no rewards for success. If you do a good job, you're just not a failure. There's no rewards there. It's very prescriptive. It's very top down from Washington. When I ran the Chicago Public Schools, I almost had to sue our Department of Education for the right to tutor my children after school. It was the craziest thing ever. It was a pitched battle. I won it, luckily, but why did I have to fight the Department of Education to tutor children who wanted to work hard after school? Absolutely crazy. It led, I think this was unintentional, but it led to a dumbing down of standards, and it led to a narrowing of the curriculum, and it's one of the biggest complaints I hear as I travel the country. So how do we reverse all those things? We have to reward success. Great teachers, great principals, great schools, great districts, great states, where we're raising the bar, closing the gap. We have to make sure we shine a spotlight there and really reward folks that are doing tremendous work. we have to focus much more on growth and gain rather than absolute test scores. How much are students improving each year? What are we doing with graduation rates? We have to look beyond one simple, you know, test at the end of the year and get beyond that. I think we can do that. We're seeing huge courage from states. 40 states have raised standards, college and career ready standards over the past 2 years. You've seen more reform recently than you have over the past generation, as the president said of the state, in the State of the Union. That's not due to my leadership or anyone in Washington. That's at the local level, tremendous courage, tremendous vision. We're finally going to stop lying to parents, stop lying to children, and raise the bar. And finally, we have to support what we call a well-rounded curriculum. So reading and math are important, but science, social studies, environmental literacy, financial literacy, foreign languages, dance, drama, art, music, physical education, all those things can't be seen as extras. That has to be the norm, particularly not just the high school level, but at the elementary, you know, first, second, third grade, where students are starting to, you know, build their sense of self-esteem, develop their interests. They have to have access to that. So we can fix all that. We can do it in a bipartisan way. These are common sense fixes. At the end of the day, where I think the law got fundamentally wrong, it's interesting from a management standpoint. It was very, very loose on goals. So you had 50 different standards, 50 different goalposts, the vast majority of which were dummied down due to political pressure, but very tight, very prescriptive on how you hit those goals. I think that's backwards. I think we should be tight on the goals, have a high bar, college and career ready standards, so you know with your children, I have a third grader and a first grader, I want to know, are they making the right steps to be successful once they graduate? But give much more flexibility, frankly, get Washington out of the way. Let great teachers, great parents, great local educators, they know what's right for their children. When I ran the Chicago Public Schools, I couldn't micromanage 600 schools. I don't want to try and micromanage 95,000 from Washington. Can't be done. Let's really empower folks at the local level, hold them to a high bar. So we can fix it. We want to work in a bipartisan way, and we want to do it this year so we go into the next school year in the fall with a much better law.
Thank you.
We're also taking your questions through a live chat on Facebook. So if you go to whitehouse.gov/live, we're getting a lot of great questions. This one just came in from John Gallagher. John says, knowing that students in the top 10 or so in their graduating class or on the honor roll are involved in music, art, and theater programs in their schools, and knowing that the arts are providing things like creative problem solving and higher order thinking, skills that are needed in the 21st century employment, how are we going to sustain our arts programs in light of our current economy and cuts to education?
Yeah, these are really thoughtful questions and something I actually worry a lot about. You see lots of places where arts are being cut. You see places where schools are going to 4-day weeks rather than 5-day weeks at a time when we need more time. So in our budget request to Congress, we're actually asking for $1 billion to fund what we call a world-class, well-rounded education. So it's not just the math and the reading, but it is all the other things. They're somehow seen as extras, but they're not extras. They have to be the norm. So we want to put a huge amount of resources with Congress's support behind those states and those districts that are really committed to giving children a well-rounded education. I can't emphasize enough, it can't just be at the high school level. It's got to be with our young children, our 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 year olds, and give them those kinds of opportunities. So we're trying to make an unprecedented investment. That's actually one of the pillars of where we want to go, is behind what we call this well-rounded education.
Great, thank you. Liz from Good.
Fabulous. So Good is a platform for people who really care deeply about changing the world, and we asked our readers to come to good.is, and they submitted hundreds of questions for you, and it was hard to narrow them down, but the first one, I know, the first one actually comes from a City Year Corps member named Jasmine Cabezas, who's out of Los Angeles, and she says, the president discussed the shared responsibility of schools, parents, and teachers in education. However, there are many more players on the field. How do you see the role of nonprofit organizations like Communities and Schools, KIPP, or City Year in turning around our nation's lowest performing schools? And to take her question a step further, how do you see, additionally, the role of citizens and businesses in that?
So I love the question. First, let me say how much I love City Year. I try every chance I get here to volunteer with them. I actually helped to bring them to Chicago, and they did an amazing job across the city, but I pushed them hard to focus on our schools, and they did that. We have City Year teams around the country who are actually dedicated to ending these dropout factors and ending the dropout crisis and going into some of our toughest schools and really trying to be those great role models and mentors for students. And so I can't tell you how much I appreciate the spirit and the inspiration that they provide throughout the country. When folks see those red jackets coming, it's just a great thing for those communities, and I just can't say enough about it. For us to get where we need to go as a country, none of us gets a pass. All of us have to do more. And so we're challenging everyone. We're challenging parents. We're challenging students. We're challenging teachers. We're challenging principals. I talked about, as hard as we're pushing everyone else, we're trying to look in the mirror and be very self-critical and change the way we're doing business. I think our department, frankly, has been part of the problem historically. Businesses, philanthropic community, but specifically this question, nonprofits, social service agencies, faith-based institutions, my vision is that schools really become community centers. Schools should be open 12, 13, 14 hours a day, a wide variety of after-school programming. In every neighborhood in our country, rich, poor, black, white, Latino, doesn't matter, we have schools. Schools have classrooms, they have libraries, they have computer labs, they have gyms, they have pools. Those are great physical resources. They don't belong to me or to the principal or to the union. They belong to the community. Why are they open 6 days a week? It makes no sense. One of the things I was proudest of in Chicago is when I left, we had 150 schools that were fully community centers, were open these longer hours. We had a huge number of nonprofit partners who were co-locating services in our buildings. This was the best money I spent. For every dollar I spent, we were getting $5, $6, $7 back because of these partnerships. We had schools that we ran to school from 9 o'clock in the morning to 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And then from 3 o'clock in the afternoon until 9 o'clock at night, the Boys and Girls Club ran the school. And these are really tough economic times. We talked about it. Nonprofits, social service agencies are struggling for money. My question is, why do we keep putting that into bricks and mortar? Let's put them into our schools, don't charge them any rent, give them the buildings for free, and let them put all their scarce resources behind tutoring and mentoring and enrichment activities. And if schools truly become the centers, the hearts of the neighborhood, activities for children, for students, for their brothers and sisters, for the parents, GED, ESL, family literacy nights, family counseling, whatever it might be, math nights. When those schools become the hearts of the neighborhood, those children are going to do extraordinarily well. And so the nonprofit community, social service agencies, and faith-based institutions have a huge role to play. And the more we think about our schools as these hearts of the neighborhood, not as these islands that they've been to often, we have to open our doors. We have to invite these partners in. Let them co-locate. Let's have 5, 6, 7, 8 different partners in the same building. Take some coordination. Take some work. But the dividends for students are huge. Not to go on too long on this, but I'm passionate about it. We actually did some interesting studies of this in Chicago. We saw, you know, results go up. We saw attendance go up. We saw discipline problems go down. One that I wasn't smart enough to think about, we saw mobility go down. We had a highly mobile population. 85% of our students live below the poverty line. Families are often one step ahead of the landlord. But in these community schools, even if families were living in transition with some degree of chaos, because they were tied to that school, they found a way to come back. And to me, that was so critically important. When students' lives are unstable, lots of things going on, that one source of stability, that one source of strength has to be the school. And these community schools help to keep students anchored. And so I can't say how important that is. And you're seeing districts around the country start to move in this direction.
Thank you.
I'll try and shorten my answers.
And now I'm going to turn it over to Rob from PBS Teachers.
Thanks very much. We had an overwhelming response on pbsteachers.org. We got the teacher community was very excited by the administration education statements by President Obama in the State of the Union address. In fact, we had over 500 questions and 11,000 votes for those questions. One of the most popular was posed by Aaron C. of Boston speaking to merit pay. How does merit pay address those who have chosen to teach in country's neediest students, those in low-income areas, special education students, ELL, and court-involved youth? Will I be penalized for choosing to work with the students who are most in need?
That's a great question. I think the goal is exactly the opposite. The goal is to reward folks who are taking on those tough assignments. And let me be clear, no one goes into education to make $1 million. I think teachers and principals are the most altruistic people around. But I do think when you're taking on those really tough assignments in disadvantaged communities, inner city, urban, rural, whatever it might be, we should reward those folks willing to do that hard work and pay them a little more. And again, they're not doing it for the money. To me, it's almost a symbolic token of our appreciation. But I would argue that historically, there have been very few incentives and frankly, lots of disincentives to take on those tough assignments. And what I keep saying is if we're serious about closing achievement gaps in this country, we have to close what I call the opportunity gap. And we got to give our children who need the most help, the hardest working, the most committed teachers and principals. They make a huge difference in students' lives. So I've argued, not everyone agrees with me, we have a shortage of math and science teachers. It's hard to instill a love of math and science if you don't have teachers who know the content. In these struggling communities, let's pay a math and science teacher who's doing a great job, pick a number, 10 grand more, 15 grand more, 20 grand more. We've had a shortage for a couple decades. I don't want to keep talking about it and admiring the problem. I want to try and fix it. So where folks are working in disadvantaged communities, very tough working conditions, lots of turmoil sometimes at home in the community, that's tough work. They're doing heroic work. We need to recognize it and we need to reward that. And I think we've been too shy to have those conversations. So we need to be thoughtful in how we do it. Again, focus not on absolute test scores, but growth and gain, how much students are improving each year. Focus on which schools are producing students that are graduating from high school and moving on. We have some amazing success stories of schools where just a couple years ago, 70% of students were dropping out, and today 85% are going on to college. You know, radically different. That's hard work. That's phenomenal work. Let's find ways to reward that and be thoughtful and do it in partnership with teachers.
Great. We've got a live conversation that's happening right now on Facebook. If you go to whitehouse.gov/live, you can join the chat. This question just came in from Misty Treppard. Misty asks, my son is constantly getting bullied at school. The teachers and other faculty do nothing to stop this. What are we going to do to address this in our country?
It's a huge concern. And what we're seeing, unfortunately, is young people, whether it's elementary, high school, or at the college level, we have some young people taking their lives because they're being bullied and just can't take it anymore. They can't tolerate it anymore. So this is something we're taking very, very seriously. Unfortunately, bullying takes more forms today than when I was growing up. It's not just physical bullying, it's cyberbullying. It's very, you know, subtle ways that students, unfortunately, at times can be very cruel to their peers. And so we've tried to be absolutely clear. We've pushed states very, very hard to adopt policies that have zero tolerance for this and deal with it openly and directly. Every adult in that building, teachers, counselors, social workers, principals, everybody has to be part of the solution. We're challenging students to step up and sort of break the code of silence. When these kinds of things are going on, almost always another student knows. We have to create the climate of safety where they can speak up. I would urge the mother, if this is not being addressed at the, you know, go to the source, talk to the teacher first, the principal. If that's not being addressed, go to the superintendent, go to the school board. We're seeing many states come up with much more thoughtful and comprehensive policies, but those policies aren't being followed at the local level. They're frankly for naught. And so I'd urge the mother to escalate this, to not be shy about this. We want parents demanding more, asking more questions, challenging us, holding all of us accountable. And if we want our students to be really successful academically, they have to be free of fear. If you're scared, if you're worried about these kinds of things, you just simply can't concentrate on what we want you doing. And so I say there's a series of foundational things: students living free of fear, students being fed, students having eyeglasses, students having the physical and emotional and mental health needs met. Those are like foundational building blocks upon which we can have great academic success. Without those, it's a house of sand.
Well, Misty is still in the chat. She said thank you for addressing that question. If you have other questions for the secretary, go to whitehouse.gov/live. I'm scanning your questions now. I'm going to turn it over to Linda from Baby Center for the next question.
I have a question from our audience about the role of the federal government in education. We have a decentralized system, and in some ways that's great. States make decisions, local districts make decisions. But what really can the federal government do? What should the role be? And very specifically, people had curriculum questions. We have so many different curriculums around the country. How can we raise our math and science standards when we don't really have a standard?
Great question. Complicated answer. I'll try to be brief. What I think our role in going forward, we frankly want to have a narrower federal footprint. We want to provide much more flexibility. We started that at the top of the conversation. I think our role should be to recognize and build upon and encourage the excellence at the local level. I think education has been, always will be, a local decision. The vast majority of funding, in most 8, 9, 10% of money comes from us. The vast majority of funding is state and local level. What we're trying to change ourselves, as hard as we're pushing everyone else, is our department has been this large compliance-driven bureaucracy. We're trying to change the business we're in to being this engine of innovation. And with Race to the Top and 40 states adopting higher standards, that's a game changer. With 3 dozen states removing barriers to innovation, that's a game changer. We had states that had laws on their books that prohibited, it was against the law to link student achievement and teacher evaluation. All those laws are gone. So we want to continue to reward excellence through programs like Race to the Top, the Invest in Innovation Program, the Promised Neighborhood Initiative that builds upon Jeffrey Canada's extraordinary work with the Harlem Children's Zone. We have to support the great work that's going on out there. For all the challenges we as a country face, the answers are out there. The answers are not with me. The answers are frankly not with anyone else in Washington. The answers are with great teachers, great principals, great local educators getting it done. We have to take those pockets of excellence, those islands of excellence, and scale them up. What I'd say directly on the curriculum, should we ever have like a national curriculum? I would say absolutely not. What we should have is high standards. And for the first time, our country is moving towards high standards.
then we'll see who are developing the curriculum, who are developing the assessments, who are developing the student supports to help students hit that higher bar. And we'll be able to track who's succeeding, who's not, and folks can learn from each other. So it will never come from us, but it will shine a spotlight on what is working at the local level.
Thanks. Rob from PBS.
Second question from Wendy in Carlsbad, and addresses standardized testing. How can teachers foster critical thinking skills and creativity when so much emphasis has been placed on standardized test scores? And if that's what defines the standard, how do we do this critical thinking challenge?
So we need to move beyond the simplistic fill-in-the-bubble tests that we have today. And we actually have two consortia of states, 44 states now, working on this next generation of assessments to incorporate critical thinking skills into, you know, these more complex skills that students need to be successful in a knowledge-based, globally competitive economy. And so we're going to be in a period of transition. Again, leadership not provided by us, great leadership at the state level. We're actually putting resources behind their efforts. We're putting $350 million, so a huge investment in their leadership. And so we're going to migrate from current assessment systems to much, much better ones. And it's going to be a period of transition now, but I think as a country, we're going to absolutely break through on this. So we're going to have higher standards, we're going to have much better assessments, and this is going to drive the curriculum question, because we're going to see who's really helping to hit that high bar moving forward. The final thing I'll say on this is, to me, it's so important that our assessments not just be end of year, that we call summative. I'm a big believer in formative assessments. Ongoing periodic evaluation, so students and teachers and parents know what their child's strengths and weaknesses are. Great teachers want to know not what are they teaching, but are their students learning? And with these formative assessments, they know in real time, let's group these five students together, the whole class got this concept, eight students didn't, how do I reteach it? We're trying to empower teachers in very different ways. And where you see schools today, they're showing dramatic increases in student achievement. Almost every single one are using these formative assessments to take their craft to a different level. And that's something that's absolutely going to be incorporated in these new set of assessments, these two sets of states are working on.
Right here.
Liz from Good.
Yeah, so several of our readers were really interested in the situation of Kelly Williams Bowler, the black mother from Akron, Ohio, that you may have heard of, who was sentenced to 5 years in prison over sending her students to a district that was predominantly white and higher income, even though she was not a resident of that district. She lied about her address so that her kids would have access to a better education. So in particular, Tafari from Ypsilanti, Michigan, wanted to know, What can happen to change these things, particularly given the status of, you know, 85% of black children can't read on grade level right now in fourth grade, and parents don't have a choice. And so depending on your zip code, you're essentially stuck in a particular school site.
Deep question. Couple thoughts. First of all, I'm a big believer in choice and competition, and we're trying to support places that are willing to create new innovative schools. And so where you have great district schools, we want those replicated. Where you have high-performing charter schools, we want those replicated. Where you have schools where students aren't learning, we want fundamental change. And where children have one option and that option isn't a good one, that's just absolutely morally unacceptable for the country. And so I'm a big believer in trying to drive innovation, trying to create new options, particularly in disadvantaged communities. On topic of new school creation, right at the top has been $4 billion for the whole country. What folks haven't quite picked up on yet is we've put $4 billion behind the lowest 5% of schools in the nation, these school improvement grants. It's a massively disproportionate investment. And where you have dropout factories, where you have schools that are chronically, students are falling further and further behind, we're putting this huge amount of money, not in the status quo, but behind a very different vision. Our country, historically, has accepted the status quo. These were schools that under No Child Left Behind were like in the worst category of, you know, a failure. 91% of schools around the country, is their remedy picked other. And we know what other meant. Other meant the status quo, nothing changed. In fact, many schools that 5 years ago were failing are doing worse today. For the first time now, we have almost 1,000 schools around the country that are being turned around, that are using our resources. And this is tough medicine sometimes. Sometimes it means changing the leadership of the school. Sometimes it means changing faculty. It might mean longer hours, longer days. Often means more social workers, more counselors, more wraparound services. But where schools simply aren't giving children a chance to fulfill their great academic and social potential, I think we have a moral obligation to challenge the status quo. So this is tough work, it's hard, it's controversial. I would argue it's some of the most important work we as a country are doing. And for the first time, our nation is in the business of turning around chronically underperforming schools. Situations like that, unfortunately, haven't often been true for 2 or 3 years. Sometimes it's been 2 or 3 decades. It's been persistent, chronic failure for years and years, and somehow everyone passively watched that happen. We have to challenge it. And I'd encourage parents, and this is sort of parents have to become great advocates. They have to be willing to challenge the status quo. They have to be great partners where things are working, but where it's not working, they have to be great advocates for change.
Okay, Kevin from MTVU.
The price of attending college has increased 5 times the rate of inflation over the last few decades, and quite frankly, these prices are higher in orbit than the Sputnik satellite. So what, in your mind, brought us to this point? And will the programs that you guys are launching be sufficient in curtailing these wildly out of control costs?
Yeah, it's funny. I get this question often. I got it earlier this morning. So let me give you a couple of thoughts on it. I think our nation's system of higher education is the best in the world. I think on K to 12, pre-K to 12, we have a long way to go, but we have the best set of universities in the world. We have a couple thousand really good options. And you have some universities that are holding down costs and doing the right thing. You have others, as you talked about, where their costs are escalating much faster than the rate of inflation. I think where you have a couple thousand options, where you have smart, savvy students and parents, those places that are being wildly absorbent with cost increases, tuition increases, I think they're going to start to lose market share. All of our young people want a good education, but they want value for that as well. You see other institutions that are moving in very creative ways. You see some universities going to 3-year programs, taking 25% of the cost out of the equation. You have some universities going to no-frills campuses. Community colleges are hugely important and much more cost efficient. So this isn't what's interesting. We always think about what can we legislate, what can you mandate, what do you bully pulpit, what do you talk about? I don't think there's a legislative fix to this one. I do think that by providing transparency, giving students and families real information, using the bully pulpit to highlight successes and creativity and frankly challenge those folks that aren't doing it well, people are going to vote with their feet. And folks where costs are exorbitant are going to lose market share, and folks that are doing a great job are going to get it. And I think that's a really good thing. The final thing I'll say is, we talked about earlier, this huge increase in Pell Grants. We're trying to do everything we can to make college much more affordable. And just last week, we announced with the Department of Labor $2 billion for community colleges, for 2-year institutions. And we think that's this unpolished, unrecognized gem along the education continuum. We're trying to make a massive investment there as well.
There's a live chat that's happening right now on Facebook. We're getting a ton of great questions for you. This one comes from Julie Davidson. She asks, with all of the different forms of media available for learning, why is so much money spent on textbooks as opposed to technology? And is this something that's going to change?
It is changing.
Julie, it's changing.
I'll go out on a limb and say in the not too distant future, textbooks may be getting close to being obsolete. And we honestly have schools today that don't use textbooks. I mean, this revolution is happening. And I think using the digital media, giving students access to content 24/7, the idea of seat time and being sitting in a chair and being in a class 6 hours a day, students are on cell phones 24/7. Why aren't we delivering content there? Well, guess what? Folks are starting to figure this out. And you know, I have 2 little guys at home. This is how they learn. This is how they think. And if we're serious about, you know, increasing engagement, reducing dropout rates, keeping students focused on going to college, we have to be much more creative in the use of technology. There are lots of places out there that are starting to get great results for students using technology in very, very different ways. I think this is the future. I think it's coming much faster than folks realize. And I think it's going to help us get where we need to go educationally. And I'm happy to other situations to walk through a whole bunch of places that are doing some extraordinary stuff and getting students to learn faster and to love learning in ways that we haven't seen in a while. It's a really exciting time.
Excellent. Rob from PBS Teachers.
You just asked my digital media question.
Oh, sorry about that.
But this one from Janine in Jersey City. She asked you to comment on the decline of VOTEC programs. Why have high schools abandoned VOTEC programs? Plumbers, electricians, carpenters, auto mechanics all make decent livings, yet our schools do not offer young people proper education in these fields. These are the kids who choose to drop out.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. If anyone has paid a plumber's bill or auto mechanics bill recently, those are great professions to be in.
I think it's an accurate critique. I think as a country, we probably did a better job in the career and technical training 30 or 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. And somehow we've lost our way a bit there. I think we have to continue to invest in those careers, and obviously a whole set of new careers that didn't exist 30 or 40 years ago in the world of technology. We haven't, as a country, abandoned. There are places they're doing this well, but they're not enough. They're pockets of excellence. And I think there's often this false debate of college versus career. To me, it's got to be both and, not either or. If you want to be a great automotive mechanic or great plumber, you're not coming out of high school without a job. Some form of education beyond that, some apprenticeship, some set of algebra skills, computer skills, technology is demanded for you to be successful. And so for me, it's about providing every single student with those choices, college and career. And they can choose to go which way they want to go. But giving those kinds of opportunities in high school and even in middle school, I think it's hugely important. It will engage students who may drop out. It will give them an opportunity to become productive citizens when otherwise they're going to be struggling on the street. And it's something that we as a country have to get back to. I absolutely agree with that critique.
Linda.
Taking us back to the beginning and setting those early seeds for education, we had a lot of moms like Carissa in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, who were disappointed the president didn't talk about early education and preschool in the State of the Union address, and really wanting to know if there's a plan to make preschool really available to all children and not just low-income children.
Yeah, I think those early years are obviously the most formative, the most critical, and I frankly don't need another study demonstrating that. I think this is arguably the best investment that we can make. So one of the things that we're asking from Congress is significant money to put upon expanding early childhood access. And our department has done some stuff, not enough. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, has done a really good job, and we've tried to be a good partner with them, but we think we should be doing more. So we want to do two things. We want to dramatically expand access, but make sure it's access to quality programs. If this is glorified babysitting, it doesn't get us where we need to go. But we're asking Congress for a couple $100 million to do much more in this area than we ever had. I've talked again, it's hard to push on everyone else. We're trying to look in the mirror. This is an area where I think our department's been part of the problem, and we're trying to become part of the solution.
Great. Liz, I'm good?
Yeah, so Cynthia from South Bend, Indiana had a question around what tangible real changes should parents and students and teachers and administrators, basically anyone who works in education or interacts with schools, expect in those schools by 2012? What will schools look like and be like, and what will the results be like that you're hoping for?
So the end goal is by 2020 to lead the world in college graduates again, so everything has to be behind that. What you're going to start to see now in 40 states are higher standards. And that's going to be challenging. You're going to see students and families who thought they were sort of on track to be successful, and now they know they're a little bit behind. They're going to have to work harder. But guess what? For the first time, we're telling the truth. And I think that's a fundamental breakthrough. We talked earlier, you're going to start to see technology used more and more often as not sort of some ancillary, some set aside, but as an integral part of learning. I think you're going to see more schools starting to think about these wraparound services and really engaging communities and making schools centers of excellence. And so those are all tangible moves that I think are going to move the country in the right direction that are happening as we speak and are only going to accelerate. I'd like to come back on technology for one second. It's actually a really interesting one. I often think, and I'm not sure why, but we in the education world historically have moved too slow, have been resistant to change. And I think technology is a great example of that. Technology has already transformed how we do business in this country and around the world. It's transformed how we interact socially, and this is a prime example of that. Technology has not yet transformed how we educate children. We've been behind the curve. We haven't moved fast enough and aggressive enough. And I think very, very quickly, you're going to see a lot more thoughtful, creative, innovative use of technology as an integral part of student learning.
Great. And Kevin from MTBU. Mm-hmm.
In regards to financial aid and college access, just being aware and cognizant of your options can be your greatest asset, but it seems like many, many students are, quite frankly, unaware. So if you did have 30 seconds, say, with every young adult in the country, how would you explain this really dizzying process of navigating the financial aid system?
Well, first of all, we tried to make it dramatically simpler. So with the FAFSA form, the financial aid form itself, used to be this barrier to going to college. It was way too complex, way too complicated. It was absolutely crazy. Mm-hmm. So we simplified it pretty significantly. That's been one of the things I've actually been most proud of that we had lots of great feedback on.
What I would say to young people, particularly first-generation college goers, English language learners, is that this can't be something you start to think about senior year. This has got to be freshman and sophomore year and starting to plant those seeds and get involved early. If you have a parent who can help you navigate, great. Many young people don't. Find that counselor, find that social worker, find that teacher, find that nonprofit or social service agency that does a great job of this to help you get there. The biggest message I would send to young people is that there's a real perception, and luckily it's a myth, that you have to be wealthy to go to college. When I say to young people, I go out and say, do you know how much more money put into Pell Grants? People say, $15 million, $27 million. No, it's $40 billion. If you work hard and you're prepared to be successful, there are financial aid resources out there for you. Grants, loans, Pell Grants, Perkins loans, huge amounts of opportunity that maybe haven't been there as much historically. And so this is not about being wealthy. It's about working hard. It's about being committed. It's about getting the help, not being shy. It's about not waiting to the last minute. But if you are prepared and you're successful, I promise you those financial aid resources will be there to help you achieve that dream of going to college.
Great. I think we have time for just about one more question. This comes from the Facebook chat. Anjali Salas says, you have an excellent reputation as a champion for service learning. Where do you see service learning fit within the education climate today?
I think all of our young people, just again as a natural part of their healthy development, should be actively engaged in giving back to the community. And you know, something I've tried to do just with our own children, often partnering with City here, but going out and painting schools and building playgrounds. My wife is actively involved with a group that builds playgrounds around the country. And my children are 6 and 9, and it's something they look forward to. It's just part of who they are now. It's not seen as drudgery or not seen as service, it's seen as a fun activity. And so I think the more we're promoting those opportunities, again, not just at the high school level, but middle school and even in elementary school, the more our young people start to see the impact they can have, that's extraordinarily powerful. And I ran a nonprofit in Chicago years ago, and children in a very tough, poor, challenged community. And we did a ton of work in the community, from planting trees to working at a soup kitchen to actually literally building a home with Habitat for Humanity. And the sense of self-esteem that our kids got from those opportunities was something we couldn't have taught through our normal tutoring program or in a class. And they started to see themselves as having the power to have a positive impact and not being seen as children of the poor, children of a disadvantaged community, of all these negative stereotypes. And we're out planting trees, people would stop and look and figure out when they're building a roof, people would stop and look. And it started to change the community's perception of what young people do. So the more we're providing concrete opportunities on an ongoing way, young people love this. When I ran the Chicago Public Schools, we had a 40-hour requirement. We had students who hated that at first who went on to go do 400 or 500 hours because they got hooked. We have to continue to provide those opportunities.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Secretary Duncan, for joining us, and Rob, Liz, Kevin, and Linda, and everyone at home that tuned in. If you joined us late, this video will be posted shortly on whitehouse.gov, so you can check out the whole thing. And stay tuned. At 4:30, we have another roundtable discussion. Secretary Sebelius will be joining us for a discussion on healthcare. So thank you again, and have a good afternoon. Mm-hmm.